Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Ron. Welcome to the absolutely essential pit stop in your week that is the Q&A episode of the Two Mats.
I hope this isn't too much energy for a Sunday morning.
No.
Should we steam straight into the first question?
Well, I mean, it is the biggie, isn't it? Subject of the week. Should Keir Starmer be worried about Owen Jones resigning from the Labour Party and the formation of We Deserve Better? Thank you, Zadie in Manchester.
Do we need to explain who Owen Jones is, people?
I think we should. Owen Jones is a columnist and
activist. You've got to say that because it winds him up. If you don't call him a journalist,
yes,
and just call him an activist, he goes nuts on Twitter.
Yes, YouTube imagineer, as they say in the Disney world. Who by the way is his nickname in at the Guardian is Squealer in honor of the propagandist pig in Animal
From
Farm.
Animal Farm.
No, yeah. So wonderful. I've, which is a fun fact. However, more seriously, he has, and you know, seriously for the Labour Party and perhaps the nation, he has resigned from the Labour Party after 24 years.
Wow.
And you know, it's a more. He's written about this in the Guardian last week, and it's more in sorrow than in anger, and you know, but Starmer has just pushed him over the edge, so he's now congregating with this new group called, you know, in a slightly introspective fashion, We Deserve Better.
Should Starmer be worried?
No, I should think Starmer is absolutely thrilled because I mean historically it has always helped Labour leaders on the verge of an election if left-wing columnists, activist groups declare themselves implacably upset and go off and do something else. So I think there will have been, you know, I don't think it'll be a huge event in Starmer's.
I thought it was quite commendable, really, because he's done what he was telling people like me to do for so long, which is under Corbynism, if you don't like it, just fuck off.
Yes.
You know? And he doesn't like Starmerism, so he's fucked off.
Fair yes, enough. I mean, I think he might not... It might not lead to the sort of national uprising that he's hoping for.
No.
And it is true as well that, you know, Owen Jones is a very interesting history because he wrote an amazingly good book called Chavs.
Yeah.
I think it was his first book, which I thought was a seriously good book about class and how it had not gone away. And I thought, oh, this is going to be very interesting. But he has become, you know, he's a social media figure. He's got 1.1 million followers on X. And I think he's kind of become one of those figures for whom, you know, that and there are figures like them on the Labour left and indeed on the Tory right as well, who just won't take yes for an answer. They really won't. So, you know, the fact is that Starmer may not be his ideal politician, and it's certainly true that, and the left will never let Starmer forget this, that Starmer is sort of moved away from the pledges he made during the leadership contest and so on. But my God, you know, if you're a Labour voter, you know, what do you want? More Sunak or Keir Starmer? I don't know.
I mean, I read the piece he wrote and he does raise some interesting questions about Starmer, which, you know, deserve to be asked. I mean, as ever with Owen, it seems like it's all about Owen to me, you know. And there's a sort of streak of narcissism a mile wide running through him. However, I have to say, the guy is clearly very passionate about a number of issues and beats them to death and is strident. And, you know, as much as I have a bit of a short time for him as a personality, I think I can't complain about him, you know, shouting loudly about the things he cares about.
Look, I mean, he's a free agent. He can do what he wants.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, all I would say is that historically leaving the main parties has rarely worked out well.
Yeah.
I mean,
I can bet we deserve better. The last time you'll ever hear the phrase "we deserve better" on this podcast is
today.
Just then.
Yeah, just yeah. now. Yeah. I mean, how many people remember Change UK? Do you remember when,
yeah,
I bet, you know, Chukwuma Mounah and a bunch of other MPs yeah. decided they were going to rebuild the centre. And,
God, yeah. What happened to Chukwuma Mounah?
Well, he's gone off and into PR. And
has he?
Yes, he has.
That's a shame. He was like a great...
He was going to be the future of the Labour Party.
What a shame.
It was a shame. But, you know, that was what killed off his career because you know, there was no way back. And, you know, the Gang of Four, you know, did make some impact. You know, the SDP... David Owen, Shirley Williams, Roy Jenkins, Bill Rogers, you know, they made an impact and they made it harder for Labour to win elections, but that's about it.
The SDP is a weird party now.
Oh, now it's very strange.
Some very weird people in it.
It does. Know,
with weird ideas.
It's rather like an American style weirdo party, you know, with weird, strange, a combination of libertarian and super statist.
I think Rod Little's a big SDP.
I think Rod is in there, which I would not have expected, but there you go.
All right, well, thank you.
Anyway, you know, Godspeed, Owen.
Thanks, Zadie from Manchester. Next question, please. So, given the futility of the Lords voting against the futile Rwanda bill, isn't it fair to say the entire upper chamber is a bit futile? Very good, Sheila. Sheila from West Lancashire, thank you. Three mentions of futile there.
Yeah, I think I'm getting the feeling that futility is part of the concept behind this.
The question is there any point to the upper chamber?
There is, but it's not clear what it is anymore, I think, because it's such a... unreformed body. It's half reformed.
Yeah.
And, you know, the truth is this, I mean, this is, I don't want to get too much into the weeds in this, but this goes back to the 1911 Parliament Act, which is worth mentioning because it was designed to give the Commons supremacy over the Lords and to stop the Lords from blocking things. And in various ways, that has remained the case. So we don't actually in this country have what constitutional experts insist on calling a bicameral system, which just means
a bicameral
two chambers. I mean, it isn't like the Senate and Congress in the States, because in the end, the Lords can kind of delay and amend things and push things back, which is what they've done with Rishi Sunak's Safety of Rwanda bill, which now won't come back to the Commons until April the 15th. But it's very rare that the Lords succeeds in genuinely killing off something.
But do you think that's a good thing, that they can't genuinely kill off things?
Here's the problem is, so it's an advisory annex is really what it is.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of expertise in it, but the membership is all over the place. So all the attempts to reform it have been really focused upon the membership, which, you know, first of all, there was getting rid of the hereditaries, and then there was should the rest be appointed or elected? And Cameron tried to do this in the coalition in 2012. And the interesting thing that happened was MPs, Tory MPs, 91 of them, rebelled because they did not want a second chamber with real power.
Yeah, right.
So the question here is, and I don't have a sort of, I'm agnostic on it, but it is a very big decision if this ever comes onto the radar of, I wouldn't expect it to come onto the radar of a Labour government very soon, because so many people have had their fingers burnt by it. But do you want a second chamber that can actually, you know, really, I mean, is fully elected and can actually stop or indeed initiate and ensure that bills get passed?
Yeah.
And at the moment, there's no evidence that people do. And indeed, you know, the Senate filibuster, you know, the way that the Senate is so often used in the States to stop things happening would suggest that what would happen if we had a Senate in this country is we'd preen ourselves on our greater democracy for a bit, and then we'd end up with more legislative gridlock.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sold. Clearly what we've got now is indefensible.
Is there an argument? Why do we have a second chamber at all?
Well, the argument is that it's good to have... It is good to have a revising
like a sanity
chamber.
Check.
A sanity check, you know.
But couldn't you build that process into, like, for instance, giving the opposition more say in legislation?
You could. Richard Crossman used to argue very strongly for if we're going to get rid of the House of Lords, let's just have one chamber.
Yeah.
You know, the argument for it is that most MPs don't last that long. There are experts from other fields, you know, who have things to offer.
Yeah.
There's a strong... I mean, I think if it was elected, it would have a strong sort of regional flavour.
Right.
And probably a electoral system that was more PR-ish than first past the post. So there's that. Recently the Lords has become a bit of a joke for all sorts of reasons, you know, not least that it's become just a patronage mechanism. But it has had historically a civilising effect upon democracy, I think, in this country. Yeah. And, you know, I'd be nervous about getting rid of it because, you know, if you do have a government with a 170 seat majority.
Yeah.
You know, you are...
It's good to have dissent.
Yeah, you know, it is a check and balance. But the point that Sheila raises is a good one, which is in the end, the Commons does prevail.
Yeah.
I mean, all that will happen in this case, and, you know, God love them for doing it, is that they've kicked Rwanda a bit further down the track.
Yeah, which actually might be quite effective, really.
It's politically...
In it never happening.
It's politically very effective because it means that... I mean, Sunak really wants... He really wants flights to leave.
He's dreaming about it more than Suella Braverman now.
And even more than Suella Braverman. That's how bad it is. There's something intrinsically brilliant about... The House of Lords just saying, not yet, mate, no, not in that colour, can't do that, no, come back, I'll tell you what, come back next week, get your Reliant Robin with that. You can just imagine how he must have been seething. So for reasons that are not particularly, you know, honourable, I find it very, very pleasing.
So maybe it's less futile than Sheila and I kind of imagine.
Well, wouldn't it be great if... I mean, what you really want is someone to kill it off, and that's not going to happen. But wouldn't it be great if it proved the Lords just kept going and somehow managed to stop the thing from happening in time?
Just because they ran it out of time.
They ran out of time. Yeah, that would be glorious. And bills do run out of time.
Yes, indeed they do. All right. Well, thank you, Sheila, for that question. Next question, please.
I often hear Conservatives making a big deal about Labour and their union paymasters. Why don't Labour lean into this attack? Why not say, yes, we are influenced by the union that represents your child's teacher, the nurse looking after your mum, your neighbour, the train driver. And if Labour is influenced by the unions who fund them, then the Conservatives must be influenced by their donors. Why don't Labour ask the voters which party do they think has the public's best interest at heart? From Roy Pearce. Thanks, Roy.
I thought this was a brilliant question and a brilliant point well made. And I don't
Very
know
well
why
made.
They don't lean into it more. They're obviously a bit embarrassed of Labour, of the unions, and the union money and putting that front and centre because it gives the feel of... the Workers' Party and all of this business, which obviously has got negative connotations with a whole swathe of the electorate. But the point, the juxtaposition that Roy has made there between, you know, if you're getting 15 million quid off a guy who's just made 400 million from NHS contracts, or you're funded by 100,000 union members who work in a factory somewhere, that's definitely better.
Well, again, it comes back to something we discussed on Friday's podcast, which was, you know, the risks of always thinking that we're living in 1979. Now, in 1979, people were very, very angry about the unions, and they felt they were overmighty and keeping the government was gridlocked and things weren't working. But I don't think people think that at all.
Yeah.
And one of the things the reasons I think that is that in the wave of strikes, the train strikes, the doctor strikes, you know, all that we've just been through, it was really noticeable in the polls that the public blamed the government, not the unions.
Not the unions.
There was very little old school, you know, anti-union barons. I think enough time has passed now, and I think, you know, people see unions rightly as very important bodies that people need more than ever now, because employment is so insecure.
Yeah, you maybe know, it's the word itself, union. Maybe has got it is. Such it carries such baggage.
You know, I mean, I like you. I really like this question because I think that at the election, you can just hear Jacob Rees-Mogg talking about beer and sandwiches in number 10.
Yeah,
and I think Keir Starmer would say, yeah,
yeah,
you know, we are going to have beer and sandwiches because, you know, we want to live in a society where working people are, you know, well represented, get a good deal, a fair shake, and that's nothing to apologise for. Yeah. And you know, we'd rather be funded by them than a racist.
Well, what, I mean, one thing that I think we can all agree on, you, me, and Roy, I imagine, given the nature of the question, is this idea that you can benefit to the tune of hundreds of millions and then pay back a proportion of that to the people who gave you the contracts is utterly obscene.
Yeah.
It's just wrong. And I think, you know, Starmer should say that out front out and legislate against it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, look, beer and sandwiches are better than helicopters and kickbacks.
Yeah, that's right. That, right? Didn't Starmer say something like that?
He did. I mean,
he's done something more often than he's had helicopter rides, and that's a lot.
So I think this idea that unions are something for Labour to be frightened of, and to be fair, actually, I don't think Starmer has been like that. I mean, Blair didn't like the unions and floated the idea famously in the 90s of cutting the link entirely, and then it didn't happen. And I think that's right, because I mean, I think the Labour Party came from the unions and should stay, you know, part of it. And I think unions are going to be more important actually in the coming decades and move forward. So it's a very good question.
Thank you, Roy.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Next question, please. From Steph on Spotify. What do you think the chances are of a Johnson comeback given the continued beleaguerment of Sunak? I know a good number of people who would welcome him back. Brackets, sadly, says Steph from Spotify.
Thank sadly you. Is very plangent, isn't it?
What do you think?
Well, not this side of the election, I think. But he's only 59, which makes him, what, 32 years younger than Biden? So I think it's a bit early to rule him out on grounds of age. And the other thing is that he's made it clear all along that he would like to come back. And he's shown in the last 30 years this extraordinary power of resilience and an ability to sort of get over disasters. I have to say the disasters...
Some people may call that sociopathic.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. This is not in any sense a defense of him at all. Yeah. God, no. One thing that I do think is was too quickly forgotten was that only a matter of weeks after he'd left number 10 in October 2022 after Truss fell after a very brief premiership, you know, he came perilously close to becoming prime minister again because he did have the MPs to get into the final round.
That's right.
And he would have beaten
any
other contestant. So because the members still loved him.
And was
him.
It him that pulled the plug?
I think there are lots of things in his life. I mean, one thing is he loves his collection of old English banknotes. Yeah. And you know, he earned £6 million, I think, in the first few months. I mean, it was extraordinary. And, you know, without becoming too prurient, he does have quite a lot of dependents, doesn't he?
A few houses, an indeterminate number of children.
So his financial problems were a real factor in the dysfunctions of his premiership. You know, one must never forget he was absent without leave for a week of the crucial period of the first weeks of the pandemic because he was off trying to write a biography about Shakespeare. I mean, this is insanity.
Yeah.
So I think there'll be part of him that thinks, do I really want to leave behind this sort of open checkbook? But the honest answer is that if the Tories lose big, there will be a contingent within the Tory party and the Tory press that will say, you know, disaster, red alert, call for Boris.
Yeah.
So I'd be surprised if in some shape or form we don't see, I'm not saying he's going to be leader again. I'm certainly not saying he's going to be prime minister. Okay. I hope that's not going to happen.
But you think he might get actively involved again?
I think he can't help himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that defeat will be, it's always shattering for a party after a long period in office. And yeah. I think that the, you know, he's the secret sauce argument will become more powerful than it is this side of an election defeat.
I mean, I hope it doesn't happen. Not because I despise him, which I do, or have very negative feelings about the Tory party, which I do. But I hope it doesn't happen because it's so regressive. You know, this country needs new faces and new voices, you know, and new optimism. And that would just, putting him back centre stage anywhere would just throw all the old arguments back 10 years again. You know, it'd be so vindictive, regressive. We'd all just be talking about Boris Bloody Johnson again when we should be talking about the future.
Yes, and I was going to say it would be good for Labour, but I'm not sure it would
I don't think it would, in
the sense that I think that you're right, that it would make politics Boris-centric again.
I think it'd be too easy for Labour because you just have your checklist of things to slag him off about.
But you know. But also, you know, the media would talk about him.
Yes, totally.
When it should be talking about the new government.
Yeah, I hope so. All right. Thank you, Steph. And by the way, Steph asked her question on Spotify, which if you're listening on Spotify, it's very easy to do. You can just tap in your question or any feedback. Next question is from Tim Allen in Petersfield.
How much of today's ills of the UK can be laid at the door of the levels of inequality and successive governments' lack of a plan to tackle it? What do you reckon, Matt?
Well, I think it's absolutely fundamental. And I think, you know, to go back to how we were talking on Friday's podcast about Rachel Reeves's speech, you know, one of the key aspects of that speech was the geographical inequality.
Yeah.
You know, across the board. But what was really striking was the inequality in productivity that I hadn't realised. She said, so I assume it's true, she said, outside of London, every major city in the UK, the productivity in those cities is less than the national average. So you've got a malaise in a lot of cities, you know, in terms of the economy, productivity, workforce, you know, the north of England, there are pockets of renaissance. You know, if you go to Liverpool or Manchester, I can speak of those places because I've been there enough times to know. They feel like they're on the up, except within those environments, you've got real pockets of poverty that people wouldn't believe unless you saw it with your own eyes. You know, they wouldn't believe some of the poverty you can see in cities like Liverpool and Manchester still to this day. And everything is so London-centric, politics, economy, culture, everything, that I think the concerted efforts to make great metropolitan conurbations in anywhere north of Watford is absent. You know, the HS2, the failure of HS2, yes. I think people can talk all they like about getting from Liverpool to Hull, but and I'm sure there'll be people listening who think that that's a great train line to invest in. But the answer to improving the north of England's fortunes is to be able to get there from London quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and any half an hour you can chip off that is gold dust. And investment in, you know, when the BBC moved to Salford, you know, and that became Media City, that was a great initiative,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Really uprooted a lot of people, and it changed how the BBC thought about itself. And that trickles down a lot, where you hear now the Today programme make a big concerted effort to be having presenters in different cities around the UK. And I think that's really good. The fact that that happens now and is noticeable when you think about it is just weird. You know, we live in a nation where the great geographically, the bulk of it is pretty much ignored by all the people, yes, who make decisions.
There's Planet London and then there's the rest.
The rest, you know.
And I think that's absolutely right. And I think also, and it sort of slightly harks back to what we were saying about unions earlier, is that there's been a kind of reluctance for a long time to talk about equality, because it had the whiff of the 1970s and corporatism and the old post-war consensus and all that. And centre-left politicians have been nervous about talking about equality. But I think, again, different times require different priorities. And, you know, we have talked on the pod quite a lot about some of the, you know, truly horrific statistics about food insecurity,
yeah,
about people having to do 3-4 jobs,
yeah,
you know, and yet still needing universal credit to make ends meet. When you reach that level of inequality within communities as well as between them, you are really testing the social fabric.
Yeah.
And A, it's just morally wrong. B, it's precisely the kind of terrain where, as we saw with Brexit, populists thrive.
Yeah.
So, you know, on every level, it's really important, this. And I think centre-ground progressive politicians should not feel worried about talking about inequality. Quite the opposite.
Yeah, I agree completely. And my wife and I were talking about this the other day, and I said to her, imagine, because we were talking about, you know, we've got 3 kids, we live in the middle of London. The idea that those kids are going to be able to afford,
yeah,
starter flats in the neighbourhoods they grew up in, it's just fanciful, yeah, now, you know. And so that dynamic has changed completely. But I said to her, well, imagine if there was literally no difference apart from the bloody weather, right? Whether you lived in London or you lived in a Liverpool, Manchester, yes, conurbation, or an Edinburgh, Glasgow conurbation, or in Birmingham. Imagine if there was no real fundamental difference to your lifestyle, to the culture on your doorstep, to
your prospects.
Your prospects and the way that the decision makers thought about you. You'd move there in a heartbeat.
Of course.
And any kind of that wouldn't hurt London. I get the feeling, my belief is, London's big enough and ugly enough to look after itself in this big world.
It's not a zero-sum game, are they?
Exactly, exactly.
Of course it isn't.
And other countries, you think about Germany, it's not like the entire German universe revolves around Berlin.
No,
absolutely far from it.
Not at all.
You know,
like Frankfurt, Bonn, all these cities.
All of these great places.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, great question, Tim Allen. In Petersfield, with Petersfield could be another great centre of,
they could,
of British growth. Yeah, thank you. Right. Worried Ken from Exeter. Oh my God, Ken, don't be a worrier.
Don't worry.
Right. Ken says,
be happy.
At the weekend, Trump warned of a bloodbath if he's not elected. Does this mean that if he loses again, there's a risk of all-out civil war in the US?
Poor worried Ken. Yeah. Well,
there's lots to worry about, but maybe not specifically about this use of the word bloodbath.
The good news, and you know there's a buck coming, the good news is what he actually said, Trump, was, I'm not going to do the impression because it's serious, this one, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, that he's talking about China, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars if I get elected. Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole pause, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. So people went berserk about this because Trump using the word bloodbath makes people go berserk, interestingly. Team Trump came back and said, don't be so ridiculous. He was just talking about the auto industry and tariffs. It was a metaphor. And it's true, you know, people use metaphors like bloodbath a lot, you know, bloodbath in the city, bloodbath, you know.
Yeah.
The trouble is that when you're Trump, you force people to take everything you say literally, because this is...
you've got a bit of bloodbath form.
You've got bloodbath form. I mean, this is the guy who, it's now gone down to 88, but he's been facing 88 felony charges. You know, he stirred up an insurrection on January the 6th in which people died, and people were calling for Mike Pence to be hanged. Mike Pence has just said he won't endorse Trump, which should really come as no surprise, but appears to be news. You know, he asked his defense secretary, Mark Esper, in 2020, when there was a protest and disorder going on, if it was possible for National Guard and troops just to shoot American citizens in the leg. You know, he asked him that.
Wow.
We've discussed before, he's proposed shooting shoplifters on sight. You know, he praised the Charlottesville neo-Nazis as very fine people.
Yeah.
At that same rally, which I think was in Ohio, he began with the January the 6th prison choir singing the national anthem, and Trump saluted them.
Wow.
While they were playing. Mean, obviously, they weren't there because they're all in prison, as the name suggests. It's not just a clever name. And he called them hostages. So I kind of think, you know, we're entitled to not think he's talking metaphorically.
Yeah.
Of course, he did use the phrase, that's the least of it, twice.
Yeah. Well, that was what was weird to me, was because I've read about the backlash to the reports about the bloodbath comments first. And the backlash was, and it was from a load of quite sort of progressive, sensible types saying, this is what's wrong with the media in the States now, is that they take everything he says and make him like the devil. And so I thought, okay, and I must read the full context of what he's actually said. And then when I read what he'd actually said, it seemed clear to me that there was at least a case for saying, no, he means more than the car industry. When he says, that's the least of it, that's the least of it. He's talking about the car industry is the least of it, and there's more around it where there'll be a metaphorical bloodbath, if you like, or perhaps a literal one. So, yeah, I thought the reporting of it was justified. And I thought the sort of liberal backlash against the reporting of it, saying that if you stigmatize everything he says irrationally, then you're going to cause problems further down the line. Well, I thought there was a rational stigmatization of this.
There's a very rational thing. And one has to remember that he is a showman, and he uses shtick as a form of plausible deniability.
Right.
So he and his surrogates say, oh, come on, you know, he doesn't mean it. Yeah. Well, we're not in 2016 now.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen him being very literal about these things. And, you know, to the point where someone we've talked about before on the podcast, Mark Milley, who is head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, had to take all sorts of actions during the during the period between the November 2020 election and the inauguration of Joe Biden, to, you know, make sure everyone understood the military was not going to get involved. You know, this was not going to be a coup.
Yeah.
This is really serious stuff.
Yeah.
And so it may be funny to him, but it isn't funny for the rest of us.
Okay. Have we got time for one more question? Do we want to do the Israel one?
No, we'll do it another week.
We'll do it another week. Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Last question from Barbara in Eltham. Who do the two Matts want to be the next Bond?
You go first.
Well,
you are, of course, Sean Connery.
Certainly.
I was the best.
Certainly am. So I thought, right, I watched the last one, No Time to Die.
Yeah.
Where he dies.
He dies.
I mean,
spoilers.
Unequivocally, dies.
It's a misleading title.
They all toast his health and God rest his soul and all of that. So how come there is a new James Bond?
So what you're
explain
saying...
Explain that one.
What you're saying...
Mr. Blofeld.
What you're saying is that he can't come back.
Well, has he ever come back before? Has he ever died before?
This is really spottish, okay? But yeah. He dies in, or he appears to die, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the book.
Oh, okay.
And that speech at the end of
No Time to Die, where he dies,
is lifted from that.
Oh, right, okay.
And or kind of, but I think that there's this thing called billions of dollars, which is going to stand in the way of your faultless logic. And I think that even if he has died in the Daniel Craig-iverse, that someone is going to come in. And the reason this is topical, so thank you, Barbara, is that there was a flurry of speculation that Aaron Taylor-Johnson...
That's right, yeah. He went straight to the bookie's favourite, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah. Was going to be the successor to Daniel Craig. And he kind of denied it and said, no, I don't want to get involved in anything like a franchise. And I thought, so you haven't been offered it, is actually what that means. Right. Well, I mean, you know, come on.
Yeah. So who would you like to see?
I was a very big fan of Idris Elba getting it. I think he's great. I think he would be stunning as Bond.
Yeah.
But he's 51.
Yeah.
And Daniel Craig, I looked it up. He was only 38 when he started.
Okay.
So, you know, and they take a while. They take a minute to make these films, don't they?
Yeah.
If not Idris, I mean, someone who's been mentioned.
Can I ask the elephant in the room question? Is that because you think it's time for a bit of racial diversity in the Bond genre?
Well, I mean, I mean,
he's a great actor.
I certainly don't think it would be a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not just that. I mean, I think Idris Elba is one of the most charismatic British actors of the last sort of 50 years. I think he's incredible.
Yeah.
He's from The Wire onwards, really.
And he's one handsome man.
He's got charisma.
Yeah,
You know, and what's weird is that they certainly were thinking about him. There's no question that Barbara Broccoli, who sort of runs the firm, was thinking about him, and now it's kind of the moment has passed.
Right, right.
The worrying thing is that since then, MGM has been bought by Stepford Amazon.
Oh my God!
And you just know that Jeff Bezos, who's promised to be completely hands off,
will not be hands off. It'll be a bald middle-aged white guy, won't it?
So it'll be
with like a wonky smile.
It could be Matt Lucas, right?
Well, I was going to say Michael. I'd love Michael McIntyre would be my new James Bond pick.
Talking
I think it would add
his,
huge depth.
His sock drawer.
Just sort of skipping around.
Oh!
Skipping around.
Money penny!
Skipping around, making sort of lame gags shoots Russians.
I'm terribly... I think, you know, with Bezos being the sort of final voice, it could go horribly wrong.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Is there anyone you'd like to see? I mean,
so, seriously, who would I like to... Who would I think would be good? Have they got to be English? Have they always been English? Or sorry, excuse me, British, I should say.
No, I don't think so. I mean, people quite seriously, have mentioned. Is Henry Cavill British? I don't know.
I've no idea.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the answer is no. I mean, it can be who.
I'd like it. Well, an American James Bond, like Ryan Reynolds or someone like that. I think
Ryan
it'd
be
quite be
very
good.
They've got to have an air of menace about it.
But it's the end of the career as well. That's the other thing, isn't it? Did they ever do anything decent afterwards? Connery did, didn't he? A bit.
Yes, he did. But I mean, that's the problem, is that they take 3 or 4 years to make.
Roger Moore went on to... So when my wife and I went to China
year
1999, I think, or 2000, we went to visit the Forbidden City in Beijing, and the tour guide gives you the... gives you the audio thing, you know, with the earphones. Put it on, we're walking through this. So, hello, my name's Roger Moore. I will be your guide to the Forbidden City. This is where former Bond's
was. I mean, I went with my son to see Live and Let Die again about a year ago, and I'd forgotten that Live and Let Die is probably one of the most racist films ever made. Because what it does is it tries to sort of harness the blaxploitation genre, which when it's starring black people is one of the great cinema genres of the 70s, but when it's starring, you know, Roger Moore, who's the whitest man in acting history,
white man,
it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's mind-blowingly racist as a film, Live and Let Die. Yeah.
What's your favourite Bond line?
Well, I thought Daniel Craig in the first one, Casino Royale, he did, was spectacular.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that bit where at the beginning, before the credits, where he's intercepted a spy in a city, a double agent in a city unknown and named, and they're talking about how Daniel Craig has killed the contact.
Yeah.
And the spy who's the head of station, MI6 head of station, who's turned double agent, says, but I'd have known if you, you know, you need two kills to be a 00.
Right.
And he says, well, don't worry, the second one is. And Craig shoots him and goes, yes, considerably. I love that. I think that's a great moment. But there are so many, aren't there?
I don't think you can beat the Sean Connery on the gurney with the laser.
Oh,
inching towards his testicles, where he's starting to get a bit panicky. And who's the villain in it? I can't remember.
Goldfinger.
Goldfinger. And he says to Goldfinger, I suppose you expect me to talk. And Goldfinger says, no, Bond, I expect you to die.
I don't expect you to talk, I expect you to die! Oh, that was pure Austin Powers. It's brilliant, wasn't it?
Well, Barbara from Elton, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for that question. And don't forget, any feedback, any questions, just ping them in, please. We love your feedback. Ping them into.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.